When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. And today I want to talk a little bit about the expulsion of ethnic Germans at the end of the Second World War, really from about 1944 onwards, as the fortunes of the Third Reich decline at the end of the war, and then in the post-war period of establishment of new national and communist regimes. In the East and also in Central Europe, a more state-led and official expulsion of ethnic Germans took place. But the place to start really is the period 1939 to 1941, where Hitler and Stalin, under the auspices of the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, actually arranged for population transfers of Soviet citizens who had come under the aegis of the Nazis, and German citizens or German nationals or ethnic Germans who had been Soviet citizens. These populations were transferred under this agreement. But before we go there, I want to just discuss part of my reasoning for talking about this today. And that it's one of the stories about the Second World War that really is extremely inconvenient and doesn't easily fit into the conventional narratives of the war, that obviously the Nazis are the prime perpetrators of human rights abuses and ethnic cleansing and genocide, to entertain the idea that at the end of the war there are indeed German victims of the war, and that the war is on some level, and its aftermath, and even up into the 1950s, that there are repercussions for German people, and that the war, from a German point of view, can be seen as a German tragedy, is in the West particularly a very unpopular way of thinking of things. However, when you look at the statistics, about 12 million people between 1944 and about 1950 are expelled from Eastern Europe, back to Germany, and some to Australia, some to America and other parts of the world, some to South America. And statistics for the civilian deaths involved in that transfer of people range between a conservative 600,000 to a quite widely accepted figure of 2 million. Then you're starting to look at a tragedy on an enormous scale. A great many of those who died in these transfers had very little to do with the crimes of the Nazi regime. And as is often the way in these hugely traumatic movements of peoples and upheavals, a significant proportion of fatalities are children. It's interesting, of course, that this process happened at the same time as the much more widely known and widely understood ethnic catastrophe of the partition of India. And yet, arguably, the fate of the ethnic Germans being expelled from Eastern Europe has gone, at least outside of Germany, largely unexplored. So it was the Soviet Germans, particularly those that lived in the Baltic states and some from the Crimea, who, when handed over by Stalin, were divided by the Nazis into three classifications: the Altreich, the Sonderfall, and the Ostfahle. The first two categories, Altreich and Sonderfall, were hugely suspect as far as the Nazi racial authorities went. These were Germans who had probably a bit of Polish blood, probably a bit of Slavic blood in them, possibly even some Jewish blood. And they were kept in racial internment camps for observation and study and analysis by Nazi eugenicists and the racial scientists. I use the term scientist there in the kind of loosest possible sense, obviously. I think racial hygienist is, in fact, the term that the Nazis used, because they were saying, you know, that the body of Germany as a whole, as a believed, you know, as an organic entity, needed to be hygienically protected from these kinds of alien influences. It was the Ostfahle who were considered to be the good stock, those that were racially pure, and they were resettled in the Wartegau and East Prussia, and some in the general government of occupied areas of Poland. And these were examples of what Hitler referred to as the Volksdeutsch, national Germans. And these were going to be the colonists, the settlers, the pioneers, who were going to racially reorder Eastern Europe. And these are many of the Germans who are expelled from Poland at the end of the war. When they were actually sent to post-war Germany, into either the Soviet-occupied or, more likely, the Western sectors, for many of these Baltic Germans or even Crimean Germans, this would have actually been, at the end of the war, the first time that they had really, for any reasonable period of time, experienced the country supposedly of their origin. The beginnings of the Great German Exodus start in about 1944, when it's clear that the German army cannot withstand the Red Army on the Eastern Front, and the newly occupied parts of Poland that have been dominated by the Volksdeutsch, the Ostfahle, and also the German communities that have existed for centuries in parts of Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Romania, and beyond, these communities all begin to become extremely apprehensive and terrified, even, of the prospect of being caught by the Red Army. The amount of devastation done by Germany in the Soviet Union, calculated conservatively at 27 million deaths by 1945, the Germans are well aware of what they have done in the Soviet Union and have no intention of being caught by the Red Army. So there is, firstly, a voluntary exodus of people fleeing westwards. But this flight becomes very contentious in the last year of the war. There are various plans for evacuation drawn up, but Hitler and the senior Nazis around him all believe that this represents a defeatism, and the permission to evacuate millions of ethnic Germans from the front line shows some kind of cowardice. And there is a fear amongst the Nazi leadership, who are completely divorced from reality for the most part at this point, that this sense of defeatism and flight will infect the Reich itself, and people will simply give up fighting. And one of the principles that Hitler bases the final couple of years of the Reich on is that, you know, the country will go down in flames, they will have to fight to the end. For more on this particular topic of why Germany fights to the end, get The End by Ian Kershaw, because there's an interesting dynamic here of how the German people really are kind of tied into the regime almost inescapably after 1944, after the bomb plot against Hitler fails. But that's a slightly different story. But get that book, because it really is hugely important on this topic. During the winter of 1944 to 45, the refugee trains are frequently overrun by the Soviets, and so long columns of civilians are strafed by aircraft and attacked by tanks, and there are all manner of atrocities perpetrated against them. And the Soviets do this largely with impunity. There's very little comeback for any soldiers in the Red Army who are convicted of crimes against civilians. The next stage in the story of the expulsions happens at the Potsdam Conference following Germany's defeat. And it was at Potsdam that the borders of the new Germany are decided, the division of the new Germany is decided, and the expulsion of ethnic Germans from Czechoslovakia, Hungary and Poland is decided. The official language of the conference was that the three governments, having considered the question in all its aspects, recognised that the transfer to Germany of German populations or elements thereof remaining in Poland, Czechoslovakia and Hungary will have to be undertaken. They agreed that any transfers that take place should be effected in an orderly and humane manner. Well, orderly and humane really aren't what occurs and unfolds. The reason for the Allied governments agreeing.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Agreeing to this kind of large-scale movement of populations is firstly because the war has seen such huge population transfers and such huge ethnic violence anyway, that and this huge degree of brutalisation, that one more act really seems kind of proportionate. Secondly, the movement of populations, of national ethnic populations, into nation states based on ethnicity was part of the thing that was really begun at the Paris Peace Conference with Wilson's ideas of self-determination. And many of the post-war planners saw the causes of the Second World War in Europe particularly as being related to the failure of that process. So finally getting Poles where Poles should be, Germans where Germans should be, Czechs where Czechs should be, was considered to be part of the brutal answer to preventing a further war. The expulsion of Germans from Poland and Czechoslovakia and Hungary resulted also in the confiscation of a great deal of their wealth. And it kind of happens at the same time that the Soviet Union is doing its own ethnic cleansing. The Soviet Union is granted the eastern portions of Poland that it was given in the Molotov-Ribbentrop Agreement. It's ironic that the Allies at the Potsdam Agreement wind up honouring the Nazi-Soviet pact to some extent. And as the 2 million Poles that are expelled from that part of Poland arrive in the new Poland, which incorporates parts of eastern Prussia, so Germans are expelled to make room for them. In Czechoslovakia, with a smaller population and a much higher ethnic German population, the situation is more stark. A fifth of the population is German. That comes to nearly 4 million ethnic Germans who had traditionally looked upon the Czech provinces of Czechoslovakia as being part of Germany. The Czech government in exile during the Second World War had begun to discuss what it viewed as the German problem and had begun to explicitly insist on the removal of all Germans from Czech territory at the end of the war, partly as a result of the Lidice massacre and the various reprisals that were instituted by the Nazis for the assassination of Reinhard Heydrich in 1942. So there is a long history of state-orchestrated ethnic cleansing that goes back not to 1944, but about 1942 in regard to the Czechs. It might have been realistic for the Czech government to suggest that Germans and Czechs were unlikely to be able to peaceably live side by side at the end of the Second World War, however. The situation begins to sort of reverse itself after 1948 with the communist takeover and the suspicion that there was a brain drain from the east to the west. And after 1948, a certain percentage of the Sudeten German population is actually required to remain in Czechoslovakia, even if they wish to leave. The reason obviously being that the Sudeten Germans were quite renowned for their manufacturing and engineering know-how and expertise, and these were all going to be assets to the new Czech economy. The Soviets were really in Hungary the people who decided what the fate of Hungary's German populations would be, and the decision to expel Hungarian Germans was really dictated by the Red Army. And it wasn't just countries in the east that decided to expel their German citizens. 25,000 German citizens were forced to leave the Netherlands in 1946 as unwanted foreign nationals, even those who had married in the Netherlands and who had Dutch spouses. There was a policy instituted by Stalin of forcing German civilians to work as labour in the Soviet Union at the end of the Second World War. Many of these were German citizens, the Volksdeutsche, who were kind of overrun by the Red Army and caught, and then were shipped from Poland to the USSR in 1945-1946, and about 155,000 of them were taken. They were referred to by the Soviets as reparations labour. some figures actually put the number of Germans taken hostage in the USSR as close to 200,000, and figures of between about 50 and 70,000 are widely quoted as the number of those who died, largely as a result of cold disease and slave labour. If you consider as well that Romania and Yugoslavia also expelled their German citizens and German colonists, the problems that this presented to the military authorities in Western Europe at the end of the Second World War in terms of dealing with moving around displaced peoples was enormous. And I think this was no small source of satisfaction to the Soviets, who quite enjoyed seeing the chaos this caused British and American and other allied displaced services and people services and the Red Cross. It was only in the 1950s and then later on in the 60s and 70s that there was a real governmental and scholarly research into the scale of the expulsions and the fates really of the people involved. And the figures, again, range from about 500,000 to 750,000 deaths. And as with all these things, it depends on the study you're looking at. There is still, with the Jewish Holocaust, still some area for debate about precisely how many people were murdered, and other major demographic events and catastrophes such as the Great Chinese Famine of the late 50s, early 60s. The debate is still raging as to how many people actually died. It's very difficult to ascertain these kinds of figures. So part of the reason for exploring this, as I say, is that it is very rarely included in the historical memory of the Second World War. It's very much a kind of a footnote. And yet it's such a major demographic transformation, and it means that the nations of post-war Eastern Europe are, for the first time, very much kind of ethnically concentrated. The Poles, Czechs, Hungarians, Romanians are far more kind of far less ethnically diverse as nations as they once were. Again, which has important implications for the nature of those nations under the dynamics of the Cold War, which is something hopefully we'll look at another time. And it also raises questions about the idea of the good war. There was a very interesting article in The Guardian in January by Geoffrey Wheatcroft. It's well worth Googling if you can find it. I can't find the link at the moment, but I'll see what I can do, about this distinction between, in terms of sort of British kind of historiographies, of the First World War being the bad war and the Second World War being the good one, i.e. in the First World War, we kind of is all a different mistake, we didn't know what we're fighting for, but in the Second World War, at least there's a cause, there's a bad guy. The only problem with the analysis of the Second World War as the good war is that the majority of casualties, the majority of deaths in the Second World War are endured by civilians, and the majority of obviously deaths in the First World War are active combatants. Perhaps not ideal either, but certainly it gives the Second World War less of a kind of less justification to be referred to as a good anything, particularly. And at the end of the war, obviously, the losing side tends to incur a high degree of those casualties. And in Germany's terms, the great expulsions, and of course the aerial bombing carried out by the British and the Americans throughout the war, and the devastation caused by the Red Army, all left Germany with this profound sense in the 50s and 60s that it had endured a terrible tragedy, which meant, of course, that during the post-war era, the question of Germany and the Jews and the responsibility and the culpability of ordinary Germans to the fate of the Jews gets obscured, while the while many ordinary Germans look upon the tragedy that has unfolded the Aryan German people. Anyway, hope you found that useful and interesting. And if you want more on this kind of thing, you need to get Julia Routledge's very, very brilliant The Genocidal Century. You can get it on my website at www.explaininghistory.com, and I'll post a link underneath this podcast. Look forward to catching you on the next Explaining History podcast. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.